Thanks for tuning in for the June 15 podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology Family of Journals. Our What's Trending segment features Dr. Stacy Clardy in conversation with Dr. John Quinlan, recipient of the 2021 Ted Burns Humanism in Neurology Award from the American Brain Foundation. This week's feature interviews with Dr. Santiago Ortega Gutierrez, and it focuses on the risk of readmission following inpatient admissions for reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome.
Hi, this is Stacy Clardy. Today, I'm really excited to be speaking with Professor John Quinlan. He is the winner of the American Brain Foundation 2021 Ted Burns Humanism in Neurology Award. John is the second ever recipient, with the first winner, another famous neurologist named John Stone, having been awarded the prize last year, right in the midst of the pandemic. John Quinlan is a professor of neurology and the medical director of the Neuromuscular Center at the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute, where he's been on faculty since 1987. His roles at Cincinnati have included director of undergraduate education, director of the EMG lab, director of the EMG neuromuscular fellowship, director of the residency program in neurology, and also director of the Muscular Dystrophy Association Clinic. So really, he has spanned roles across all aspects there at University of Cincinnati. John was nominated by his colleagues and ultimately named this year's recipient of the Ted Burns Humanism Award. This award specifically honors a member of the neurology profession exhibiting humanism through humble leadership, advocacy, innovation, and creativity, a rare combination. Our listeners will, of course, appreciate that Ted is the founder of the podcast and continues to innovate and advocate despite his now almost decade-long battle with metastatic cancer. So, John, it's a tremendous accomplishment to receive this award. I think in our hearts, all neurologists would love to be described as humanistic, as a humble leader, as an advocate, or even as an innovator. You've been described by your nominators as all of these. So I'm hoping you'll share a bit of your background with us today, maybe some wisdom learned along the way. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks, Stacey. It's really an honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you. I won't embarrass you by reading the nominating materials of your many colleagues, but let's start with the obvious. How did you get into neurology?
Well, when I was a kid, my family doctor was really a nice man, very funny, very engaging. And then as I got into medical school, I loved what I was doing there. Now, I have muscular dystrophy, so I had some limited options in terms of what sort of fields I would go into. And then I looked into neurology. I met some very neat neurologists early in medical school, and I saw just how well this career fit. And that's how I ended up here. And it was a real good set of opportunities and people to meet.
Wow. So I didn't know that. So with the muscular dystrophy, did that, two questions really there. One, do you think that that helps you to be a better neurologist to your patients? But I'm also interested, when you were making a decision, were you drawn to neurology because of that? Or did you subconsciously almost have to come about to neurology in a more circuitous route because you had muscular dystrophy? Did you avoid it at all? What was that journey like?
Yeah, that part was, I originally thought I wanted to be a family practitioner, but then as I saw certain limitations there, I did the reality check on that. And I was kind of drawn to academic areas in medicine, but then I sort of backed into it, where I went to Canada for 3 months and was looking into some research there and worked with a really amazing neurologist. And it was just so much fun. And I saw it really had all the intellectual aspects, the technology, and the long doctor-patient relationships that you could see formed. So it was one that my classmates saw it from the beginning, but I recognized it by my junior year.
Exploring everything. Maybe that's the nature of a neurologist at the core.
I think we are pretty reflective.
So over the course of your career so far, what has been the most rewarding project or undertaking that you've been involved with?
Well, I'd say medical education. That's just working with the students and really working with the whole range of the students, because I started out running the clerkship and then working in the residency program, then up in fellowships. And so really I teach across the whole range. And even now I do some early work with the first year students when they come in the learning community. And then also, trying to think about how we teach and work with our colleagues. How do we interface well with primary care? Things like that. So it's this teaching part that is really, I would say, the the most enjoyable aspects, and it really affords so many opportunities.
And so you've really been quite a successful educator. Has it ever been challenging in academics, even though, yes, our stated mission, you know, is education along with research and clinical care, has it ever been a challenge to you to gain support or protect your time to engage in all the educational endeavors that you've undertaken?
Yeah, it really has. And that's why the whole situation has evolved over time. Initially, when I started out, you pretty much had to work really, really hard and then do things that made a lot of money. In my case, it was EMG. So you basically, that would pay for the time you use for education because there was no money for education. So you kind of had to earn it in terms of carrying your load on the teams, you know, in terms of consult duties and hospital services and other things. And then almost you had to generate an excess with your activities. Nowadays, there's been a really good evolution in this. And I think that this is right now, our College of Medicine is quite good in terms of carving out fractions of your full-time equivalent to do certain activities. And we're moving along pretty well, I think, in terms of doing that with a lot of the different named sort of teaching activities that we have. So there's been an evolution that I think is quite encouraging, actually.
Well, that's good to hear. So given that, you know, you had to squeeze some of these things in your spare time, if you will, anything that you feel like, oh, I missed an opportunity, any big regrets in your career to this point, or even perhaps something you would change if you could?
Well, there's no regrets in the sense that I'm always afraid of, you never know the path untaken. And I think if I were to change something, I'd afraid of long-term consequences. So I don't have regrets. Now, things I'd like to change, so there's plenty of those. And that's where I have problems with finishing things, so I'm not a very good finisher, and also focusing. So and all those, the impact on your efficiency. So that's something I'm still working on, is to try to not overpromise and then try to concentrate on things for a period of time and trying to avoid the uncontrolled multitasking.
Ooh, I think we all hear that. So what tips do you have for us? What have you learned along the way? How are you doing better with it?
I'm getting a C minus so far, so I don't think anybody should write anything down. No, I'm working on a system where I've got my big lists, so that I feel less anxious, so I'm not losing track of major projects. And then I screen that, and then I take a little pad of paper, and I try to put maybe 6 or 8 things on that. That's my system this year. And then cross those off when they get done.
You're reminding me of 2 conflicting pieces of advice that have stuck in my head that I received when I was starting my faculty position. And both were very well-intentioned. One was, hey, you got to try to start a lot of things because only 1 or 2 of them will stick. So, you know, get your hands in multiple different pots and then try to do a bunch of things and go with what sticks. And then the other sort of camp piece of advice I got was, you know, learn to say no early on, say no to a lot of different things. So where do you fall in terms of which piece of advice is better for younger faculty?
Well, I mean, I think let's take the no question first, because that's, I think that's one where I think you shouldn't say no to patients. So when you're looking at the priorities there, and I would say patients and students. So those are 2 times I don't really say no. But part of that is the students are kind of easy because, you know, it just seems that those are easier to take care of. And the students, they're not as many, you know, there's many in the class, but the students that are contacting you for questions is a smaller number. On the patients, I think you have to have your system protect you. So, because you could certainly be overwhelmed very easily, but if your system is protecting you so that not everybody can get to you, then when a patient contacts you and asks for help, then I think you have to say yes. Now, having said that, if somebody looked at my in-basket right now, they'd see that I'm not keeping up on a lot of those things. But I guess it's when a person asks you for something, it's hard to say no. I mean, provided it's a good request. And then sometimes you have a patient that's making requests that are not reasonable and they're not good for themselves. And then those you don't honor or take care of. As far as getting a lot of projects started, I don't know about that one, because I've got a lot in that category that are just causing me anxiety right now.
So it never ends. That's what you're telling me.
Oh yeah, I don't see the borders on that one.
That's great advice for sort of a schema, right? Like, never forget why we got here in the first place, and that is to take care of the patients. And maybe in what you're saying is for second place, at least, you know, the students are at a very vulnerable time. They're a vulnerable group. Maybe other faculty members will be fine if you say no. Am I interpreting that right?
Yeah, and it's also who needs it at the time. And then, yeah, and it's, I guess it's the way I was treated when I was learning. And you just want to give the same in return. And also, I think education has got such an amazing return on investment that it's encouraging, it's inspiring to you to know that the time you spend there has got returns that are many multiples.
So how do you cultivate and maintain one sort of key element, one thing that your colleagues spoke about a lot in nominating you, and that is humanism or humility, if you like? I mean, like everyone else, you no doubt must get frustrated sometimes, all the demands, you know, things that are going on, things you're involved with. So how do you turn that back around and manifest it as ongoing humanism and humility?
Well, I mean, one thing on the humility part, and that I think is so easy to learn in neurology, because the field is so broad and so deep. So that's one where I would say kind of pretty early in my career, maybe about 5 years in, I got very comfortable with saying, I don't know, because, you know, sometimes there's a temptation to fake it, to say something that you're really not sure about. And even those things you're sure about, you can make a mistake on misremembering it. So I think that being open to say, I don't know, to your students and also to your patients, it's really quite liberating. I remember one time when I was starting out as a new attending, and I was well-trained as a senior resident, and really we had a lot of responsibility for running rounds. But if you're done with a case, you'd kind of look to your left and there would be your attending, and they'd nod, and then you'd move on to the next case. Well, the first time I was an attending, I was running the rounds for my team, and I listened to the case and I made my recommendation. And then I sort of imagined myself looking to my left, but there was no attending there anymore. But then I thought, you know what, if I don't know the answer to this, if I need some advice on a tough stroke case, I'll call one of my colleagues. You know, so it's one of those things where you're just not alone, and you don't have to do everything by yourself. And it's always a team approach rather than just being you as a solo player.
Yeah, that's it. That's several great points I heard in what you said there. One, yes, our patient population does have a way of keeping us humble regardless. But then also, yeah, I think we can all relate to the time when we have that panicked moment where we realize we're in charge. But I sort of like your perspective on that, right? You may be in charge, but you have limitless sort of friends and colleagues to help with the hard decisions.
Yeah.
So you hinted at this a little bit, but let's talk specifically about your approach to patient care. What are the essential one or two things you always try to remember to do in a visit with a patient?
Well, I would say, you know, connect with the patient and enjoy the patient. I sometimes look at a patient and I think, well, this is going to be a tough one, right? I imagine it being kind of a tough encounter by the reasons for the referral. And then you go in there and you meet the person and they're so nice. And so just to be open to the patients and enjoy just your interaction, you're just your human to human connection on them. And how can I help? And then the other side of it is, it's kind of old fashioned, but did I provide any value? When we're done with this encounter, how am I going to affect their social history? How am I going to make their life better? And sometimes, you know, we're not going to do very much. It really ranges from, you know, helping them a great deal, like knowing a disease and really bringing it under control and returning them to full function. Or it could be very little. It might be more like damage control, where you're just trying to be kind to the patient, but there's not a lot you can do for them. But just sort of seeing, am I delivering the services that is going to help this patient? And the other thing is to look at that and to not be wasteful of our resources. So And I think that waste is something we want to avoid, and efficiency, and providing good service. So it's a really challenging job to balance those things.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. It's well stated. You know, as a field in neurology, what do you think we should focus on in the next couple of decades? Imagine you're a freshly minted neurologist again. Where would you direct your energy to have the most impact?
Well, one thing is to do something you enjoy. My dad told me, he said, make sure you enjoy your job because you're going to spend most of your life doing it. And so if you look at in medicine and in neurology, there's so many different directions we can go into. And when you find yourself in an area and you find yourself enjoying it, then that's an area to, I think that's a message there. And then also to, I think to concentrate on the efficiency part where we're good, delivering good value. You know, I think of system, countrywide problems. I think it's going to be problems with, the cost of medicine. I should say the waste of medicine, because, I mean, it can cost a lot, but if we're delivering valuable products, results with that, then it's worth it. But if we're using money and time and we're not changing our plans, then that's wasteful. And we should learn to use those resources better.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So you are incredibly productive. You've continue to make significant contributions to improving the lives of, your trainees, the lives of those with muscular dystrophy in your practice, and in training so many neurologists. So give me, I don't want to maybe pick a number, 1, 2, 3 pieces of wisdom for those who are in training or early in their career who, are facing the frustrations. What would you say?
The facing the frustration part, that's one where I think we're operating in systems. We're sort of in a double bind. And I think recognizing that and maybe breaking it down and seeing precisely what's frustrating us, I think that's the way to go on that. So as you're going through your career, as you're following the work that you love to do, we're thinking about the operations and identifying problems with that to make it a better environment for us all to work in. I think that would be a good thing. Sort of pick the thing you love and then look for ways that it can be improved and be systematic and persistent in that task. That would be one thing. On the teaching side, I think to be kind, kindness and humor, I think, are the best things to add to teaching. Learning is enhanced when people are more comfortable. They need to have a little bit of anxiety in order to focus properly. But I think being kind and then making it, and then don't turn off your humor, or if you have it, I mean, be free with it, I think. Those would be two things. And then I think that when you look at medicine, everything we learn is kind of provisional knowledge because it's subject to change. Well, not everything, but a lot is. And then to be aware that our nature is really not to like change, and we don't like relearning things, and we don't like accepting that we were wrong with what we were teaching and using, 5 years ago. But that I think is really important.
Man, I wish we would have had this conversation even 10 years ago. For me, and what I've just learned from what you said, I've certainly become less dogmatic with each passing week as a neurologist. Any final words, John?
It's a great career. Neurology is a wonderful field. And how good people are that we work with. And it's so enjoyable, I think, to look at things as a team approach.
Thank you, John, for your time. Once again, I've been speaking with John Quinlan of the University of Cincinnati. He is this year's winner of the Ted Burns Humanism in Neurology Award. Based on the past 10 minutes when we've been chatting, it's abundantly clear to me why he was nominated by so many of his colleagues. Thank you for sharing a bit of your journey and wisdom, John, and congratulations.
Well, thank you, Stacey. It's a real pleasure to get the award and to talk with you.
And for our audience, you can find information on John and also the Ted Burns Award on the American Brain Foundation webpage. You could probably just Google American Brain Foundation Ted Burns Award. And you can also click on the link to show your support in recognition of John Quinlan and Ted by donating any amount, a few dollars on up to maintain the award in perpetuity. I think we can all agree we need to support the recognition of those who strive to embody humanism, advocacy, and innovation in our field. Thank you.
Hello there. This is Andy Sutherland. And for this week's Neurology Podcast, I have the great pleasure of speaking with a friend and colleague, Santiago Ortega Gutierrez from the University of Iowa. And we're going to be talking about a paper published in this week's issue of Neurology titled Early Risk of Readmission Following Hospitalization for Reversible Cerebral Vasoconstriction Syndrome, or RCVS, as we'll use throughout the podcast. In this paper, Santi and co-authors analyzed non-elective 90-day readmissions in patients with RCVS using data from the Nationwide Readmissions Database from 2016 to 2017. Now, for most of us in the world of neurology, we think of RCVS often as a monophasic vasculopathy presenting with a hallmark thunderclap headache, plus or minus additional complications of cerebrovascular disease, often triggered by some sympathomimetic or adrenergic or exertional activity or exposure. And I think that one thing that's interesting about this paper is the idea of patients being readmitted following this so-called reversible syndrome. So we're looking forward to the podcast. And Santi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's a great pleasure to be here.
You know, why don't we jump right in? And Santi, if you will, just tell our listeners, what was the main finding from this analysis of readmissions in patients with RCVS?
Well, Andy, as you very eloquently stated, we really evaluated the 90-day readmission rates following hospitalization for patients who initially were admitted with the diagnosis of reversible vasoconstrictive syndrome. And for that, we used the Nationwide Readmission Database from 2016 to 2017. This gave us the opportunity to really evaluate all the admissions of RCVS within the study period. And a total of 1,157 patients were admitted with the an index Culprit diagnosis of RCVS. What is interesting is that a total of 164, which represents 14% of the sample size, had to be readmitted later on. When we look at those patients, we realize that the majority of these patients were females with a mean age of 48 years of age. And when we compare those patients with the readmission rates of a stroke and TIA respectively, the percentage are very close, 14% versus 16% for TIAs and 80% for the strokes. That is quite striking, and we did not expect to really see this finding. When we look at the most common causes of readmission, we realize that were primarily acute cerebrovascular events, including hemorrhage, TIA or ischemic stroke, followed by recurrent symptoms from the initial admission, infections, and worsening headaches. What is more interesting is the timing of readmission. For hemorrhagic strokes, the mean time for readmission was at the end of the first week, early second week. And for ischemic stroke, it went all the way to the third week after discharge, which was quite striking when we think about a benign monophasic syndrome that usually it resolves on its own after discharge. We also look at the predictors of readmission. And here we realize that people with diabetes, history of smoking, opioid use, previous opioid use, and longer length of initial hospitalizations were the main predictors for readmission in these folks. We also did a cost analysis to really identify the burden of readmissions in our current system. And we realized that the average cost, direct cost of one readmission was about $15,000 per patient. And the median time of hospital stay during the readmission was about 5 days. Finally, we also look at the disposition outcomes of these patients. And we really realized that those patients were sick. Only about 60% of them were able to go home. About 40% were discharged to acute rehab or subacute rehab after the readmission.
Well, Santi, I think that, you know, this is some data that's sort of eye-opening about patients who are hospitalized with RCVS for many of the reasons that have already been mentioned. But I'm curious, you know, having seen this data now and these high rates, or I guess relatively high rates of readmission for a high-risk subgroup of patients with the condition, how do you think it influences our understanding of the natural history of RCVS, and in particular, how it might influence how we counsel patients, family members, and prognosticate outcomes in this patient population?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Andy. Definitely, it probably is too preliminary for counseling patients and family based on our study results. This is the first study showing that high rate of readmissions. But what is clear is that there is a subgroup population that might not fit the typical profile that we have when we think of RCVS. With this nationwide database, we are a little bit limited to really identify the clinical and imaging data, and we don't have much granularity about that. But definitely, we realize that there is a subgroup high-risk population with worse outcomes. What it would be ideal would be probably to have a follow-up prospective multicenter study in which we can really evaluate these early biomarkers, neuroimaging and serum biomarkers, to identify this highest risk population early on. That will allow us to perhaps consider older vasoactive medication or therapies such as long-acting calcium channel blockers and really get better follow-up protocols, perhaps 1 week after discharge for the patients that might have a higher risk of readmission and worse outcomes after initial discharge.
So it sounds like we know a little bit more. This data helps inform, you know, what we know about some of the associated risk factors or variables that may influence the likelihood of readmission following RCVS, but that it maybe is too early to tell which subgroups are more prone to these recurrent or late occurrences of cerebrovascular events. Is that fair to say?
It is indeed. Before this publication, using the same database, we have identified that patients that who present with ischemic stroke, hemorrhagic stroke, or subarachnoid hemorrhage have a much worse outcome and higher index of readmissions and disposition other than home. However, with this database, we have certain limitations about really identifying medications associated with this potential worsening population, as well as the clinical nuances of the presentation. We found, though, that patients who are readmitted both have an increased incidence, interestingly, of anxiety and depression, which probably correlates with the increased use in that population of serotoninergic vasoactive drugs that potentially could trigger and worsen the symptomatology of RCVS.
That's interesting, Santi, because I wanted to ask sort of in one of the follow-up questions about whether or not the data included anything about concomitant medications, adrenergic or sympathomimetic exposures or exertional activities that may have been associated as ongoing triggers. You know, we've seen some cases, I've seen cases in practice where they may continue to have events, but oftentimes there may be a situation where the offending exposure is still in the milieu and that can have that influence. And then, of course, you already mentioned, but I was curious as to whether or not the data also included any information about treatments such as calcium channel blockers, which are often used ostensibly to stabilize the vasculopathy.
I think that is the next step that we are now investigating. The readmission database doesn't have information about medications, but we are using another nationwide database that really contains the admission medication and now evaluating exactly what you described. What are the potential triggers, such as adrenergic medication or exposures? Not all, every time it's collected, but we have, as we know and we see in clinical practice, a lot of patients have been exposed days before or weeks before to vasoactive medication, including some alpha blockers or new serotonergic and or epinephrine medications. And I think that is going to be the natural next step for our group to really investigate and put this together with our current findings.
Well, very good, Santi. Well, it sounds like this is a great sort of first step to really try to understand this disease and particularly the subset of patients who may be subject to worse outcomes in general, but then also in particular potentially recurrences that can not only be bad, obviously, for the patient and challenging from a treatment standpoint, but it can also complicate the diagnostic process as well about whether or not you truly are dealing with a reversible or so-called reversible vasculopathy versus something that may be more insidious, such as a inflammatory vasculitis. So nonetheless, it sounds like, well, more to come with your ongoing research. I'll encourage all of our listeners to check out the full manuscript in the Journal of Neurology, again, titled Early Risk of Readmission Following Hospitalization for Reversible Cerebral Vasoconstriction Syndrome. This has been Andy Sutherland speaking with Dr. Santi Ortega Gutierrez, and thanks again for listening. Thank you.
This is Jose Merino. Don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on equity, diversity, and inclusion, global neurology, and innovations in care delivery. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article that compares PET and MRI biomarkers to predict cognitive decline in patients with preclinical Alzheimer's disease, as well as a study exploring diseases and symptoms in the 5 years preceding a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.